Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Luke Groman, the founder and president of FFTT Capital, or Forest for the Trees Capital. We are going to be discussing dollarization and de-dollarization, treasuries, bonds, gold, Bitcoin, and all the fun topics that people around Bitcoin and macro Twitter like to usually discuss. So, Luke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, SaifEddin. I've been a longtime fan and follower, so I've had this for years. It's all marked up inside, so I'm really excited about our conversation.
Well, thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to hear that. Thanks a lot. I also follow your work with quite a bit of interest. Very, very provocative and interesting. So I guess to begin with, let's begin with your overarching thesis on de-dollarization. Why do you think the world is de-dollarizing? How do you see it happening? And where do you see it going?
I think there's the reason the world's de-dollarizing is out of necessity. If they don't do it, if they don't de-dollarize, paradoxically, the dollar-centric system as it's been structured since 1971 and really since the early 80s will unwind, collapse. And paradoxically, that collapse will feature dollar up, not down. It'll feature rates up, not down, and it'll feature at first stocks down and then probably stocks up. But the reason this is happening is there's three very powerful forces that are buffeting the global economy. And these three things have never happened before in unison. First, you've got the first bursting global sovereign debt bubble in 100 years. And this time it's being led or centered in the West rather than in the emerging markets, as has always been the case over the last 40 to 60 years. Number two, you have peak cheap energy, peak cheap oil in particular, peak cheap commodities more broadly, which is not to say we are running out of commodities, but we are or have run out of the cheap stuff. And then the third key point is that something Jeff Booth has written a great book about, The Price of Tomorrow. Technology is imposing a non-linear deflationary force on a widening portion of the global economy. And that these three things, when you put them together, leads to a very difficult situation where the global sovereign debt bubble needs negative real rates or else it will go into a debt spiral centered in the West. Dollar up, rates up, wash, rinse, repeat till the system comes unhinged. At the same time, the energy market, so you need high inflation relative to rates. You basically need significant continued negative real rates to prevent the global sovereign debt bubble from bursting chaotically. At the same time, you need high inflation in energy and commodities more broadly to incent the continued growth of commodity production to prevent shortages of those commodities, to provide the commodities you need to drive the growth, to support the economic growth, to support the debt. So the debt bubble needs low inflation, and the commodity situation needs high inflation. Those two things are fundamentally incompatible. And then layered on top of this, complicating things further, you have the inexorable and exponential deflation imposed by deflation, which also tugs on the debt because the debt needs some inflation, but not too much inflation, because the debt is so high that too high inflation makes the interest payments unaffordable to the governments without printing the money. And technology is pushing it in the exact opposite direction. It's enforcing deflation. So you have these extremely powerful countervailing forces. And these are the three forces that are ultimately driving the de-dollarization of global commodity markets out of necessity, out of self-interest. China's not doing it necessarily because they want to. They're doing it because if they don't, their economy will collapse like Southeast Asia in the late 90s.
I see. So, I mean, I think this sounds pretty compelling on many levels. I think certainly the global sovereign debt bubble has been a big one. I think it's been many decades of mainstream economists saying these things only happen in dysfunctional banana republics. They don't happen in rich countries that have rule of law, and basically white European countries and Japan don't get these things happen to them. They can just continue to borrow forever and ever and ever. And the last 2 years have been quite devastating for that thesis, because if you've held bonds over the last 2 years, I mean, it's just, to borrow a Michael Saylor phrase, it's all your models are completely destroyed. Everything that the post-world order has rested upon was the idea that you don't need to hold gold. Gold is a yellow petrock. And in order to have a store of value, in order to have a hard asset, you just hold government bonds. That's the new gold. You know, it's better than gold because it's connected to the global financial system. You can send it around, and as they famously used to say, you can't eat gold. Whereas, of course, as we know, government bonds are absolutely delicious and nutritious. And also, they offer you a yield, as all the people in the shitcoin industrial complex have found out. Just like sovereign debt investors, if you're getting a fixed yield, you are the yield. There's no yield. The notion that you're going to make positive real returns out of lending to governments that spend on all the crazy things that they spend money on and lock people up to try and fix the flu. You know, if you fell for that, you might as well just fall for Luna and all these other yield scams that we've seen in the digital currency space. So that's clearly, I think, very compelling that there is a global sovereign debt collapse happening. And it's absolutely startling, and most people have no idea of how to deal with it. I think the startling thing about it is the same people who said this thing could never happen are acting like it just doesn't happen. You know, it's a very amazing, the Wile E. Coyote moment where he's hanging in the air and just about to fall, and he's just looking around in denial about the fact that he's going to fall. It hasn't sunk in yet. So I remember, you know, very little coverage of the destruction of the value of bonds, very little discussion of alternatives. And when you see people saying, writing articles, you know, I've seen several articles along these lines in the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal, going along the lines of, well, this has been a horrendous crash for bonds. And if you're holding bonds, you probably shouldn't be looking at your portfolio too often. And you should probably be doubling down because we've hit the bottom and it can't get much worse than this. And it just keeps getting worse. It's you know, for those of us who are familiar with the shitcoiners, this is classic shitcoiner cope. You know, when you see when, say, Luna, the algorithmic stablecoin, was crashing, you heard a lot of people saying, well, it's already down significantly, so now it's only up. Now is a great time to be buying. And a lot of people got ruined because they bought in the crash. And I think something similar seems to be happening with the digital, with the analog shitcoin space of sovereign debt, where perhaps it seems to me like this, I mean, if I were to make the kind of best case scenario, which you won't get bond bulls to say because it's not a very good scenario, but I think, you know, if you wanted to say this isn't going to be tragic, well, you know, we have a couple of more years of significantly high inflation in real terms, regardless of what the CPI shows. And then you devalue bonds in real terms. And so you raise government revenues because, you know, when inflation goes up, government revenues go up. People are paying more, so people are earning more. They're earning more in nominal terms, but they're not earning more in real terms. So government revenues would go up, and then that allows them to pay off their old debt liabilities. And people who have debt, who have sovereign debt, will witness their bonds devalued in real terms, but they'll still get paid. And, you know, knowing bond investors, they'll still be happy about it and still be telling you that you can't eat gold. So don't you think that inflation can just fix this? More and more inflation, more and more devaluation of the currency, and therefore more and more easing the fiscal burden on governments. What exactly do you see as preventing there from being inflation? Why is this not a viable track for governments to take?
Well, it is a viable track in terms of inflating down debt to GDP. It is a viable track, and it's what the U.S. government and really all governments did after World War II, the last time global sovereign debt was as high as it is. And so in the United States, you had negative real rates of negative 13%, right? So inflation was 13 points higher than the yield you got on your bonds. And the U.S. was the winner that had no war damage. If you start going to the losers who had significant war damage, the real rates were a little bit more draconian. In Japan, they were negative 60%. Even in across Europe, Italy, negative 30, negative 40% is where real rates bottom. So you're losing somewhere between a third and two thirds of your money in real terms in a year, and really most of your money in real terms over a span of several years. And that was how the world delevered. Thank you for your donation to the war effort. You're a patriotic citizen. Congratulations. And that is a viable track again. The challenge that it has been and remains is that once you get debt to GDP too high, so for the United States, 120% debt to GDP, you can't do modest doses of negative real rates over an extended period of time. That doesn't work because the amounts are just so great. And at some point, you start to see the debt to GDP stop going down and start going up again, which is precisely what has just happened in the United States. We peaked at 130% debt to GDP in the summer of 20. We got it all the way down to, I think, 118 or so, and it's bounced back up. It's now back over 120, just slightly. The issue is that the bigger the debt, the GDP number, and the bigger the twin deficits are that need to be financing in terms of the current flow, not just the stock that needs to be devalued, but the current flow. And the United States is running deficits on the fiscal side of nearly 8%, or excuse me, over 8% on a trailing 12-month basis. What that tells you is you need really high negative real rates. And I did math back for our clients in report back in 1Q21 after the second or third or whatever it was stimmy package from the Biden administration, when it looked like this is what they were doing. And what I said is, if you just do the simple math of post-World War II, where in 1946 to 51, U.S. real rates were negative, U.S. debt to GDP went from 110% down to 50%, 55%. So we lost roughly 50 points of debt to GDP that was inflated away over 5 years. We ran that same math. We said, okay, debt to GDP is at 120 in 2021. We need to get it down to 70 to 80% of GDP, because that was the last time the Fed was able to raise rates in normalized policy without blowing up the Treasury market and blowing up or something else. But the Treasury market is the big one, without creating Treasury market dysfunction, to use the parlance of our policymakers. You know, repo rate spike in 2019, March 2020, Treasury market off the run crash, et cetera. And so we said, okay, simplistically, if we're at 120% debt to GDP in April 21, and we've got 5 years to get it down to 70 to 80% debt to GDP, what, given the ongoing growth in debt that we have had, which if you went back to 08, debt to GDP, U.S. debt nominal numbers rose 8% compounded every year after 08 on average. So the CAGR debt growth in the United States was 8%. So we say, let's assume debt grows 8% as it has, and there's secular reasons that happens. And let's assume we want to take debt to GDP from 120 down to 70 to 80. What does that imply in terms of the needed negative real interest rate? In other words, what does inflation have to be? And what does the yield on bonds need to be capped at by the Fed? And what we came up with was that the U.S. would need to run a period of negative 12 to negative 20% real rates. In other words, 10-year at 3%, inflation at 15 to 23%. And we would need to run those levels of negative real rates for 3 to 5 years. That would get debt to GDP back to 70 to 80. That would, a level of debt to GDP would allow the Fed to then normalize policy without creating severe dysfunction in Treasury markets, which we have increasingly seen over the last 4 years. And then we move on. And so that's the challenge, is that they started that playbook. And then inflation picked up to 8, and the political will to continue to follow through on that playbook, which was delineated by BlackRock in the August 2019 white paper by Stan Fisher and Philip Hildebrand from the Swiss National Bank, Jean Boivin from the Bank of Canada, they stopped doing that. And so that unfortunately meant the end of debt to GDP coming down. And now you're in positive real rates, you know, on the official numbers at least. And you don't get to run positive real rates on a 120% debt to GDP and 8% of GDP deficits. Or you do, you can, but the outcome to that is a very, very, very predictable set of outcomes. You are going to trigger a debt spiral. You are going to trigger a dollar that just goes up and up and up and up and up. And you're going to trigger a rise in rates in the U.S. and across everywhere, driven by U.S. deficits crowding out global dollar markets. And you ultimately are going to cause the unwind of the system. Foreigners will have to increasingly sell their treasury reserves, putting more upward pressure to defend their currencies against the rising dollar, because you're crowding out dollar markets with these positive real rates and against these debt and deficit levels. And you're going to incent foreigners to increasingly de-dollarize their commodity imports. Because if you're anybody but the United States, you have two big dollar outflows. You've got your debt service outflows, and you've got your commodity imports, which are all done in dollars, primarily oil and gas. And so if you're trying to restrict your pace of dollar outflows, because once you run out of dollar reserves, your currency collapses. You hyperinflate. We saw this in Iran. We saw this in Turkey. We've seen this in Argentina. You do anything you can to slow your pace of dollar outflows. So you've got a huge pile of FX reserves that you can sell to address the dollar service. So you're going to be selling dollars to get selling dollar reserves, selling treasuries to get dollars to address this dollar debt service. And then you're going to accelerate your pace of de-dollarizing your commodity imports. So if you're China, you're going to say, hey, Iran, Russia, Saudi, Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, sell to us in yuan, and we will net settle that in Chinese. We'll settle it in Chinese goods. What can you do with the yuan? You can buy stuff from us. And oh, by the way, we're the factory of the world. It's a pretty good deal. And anything you have surpluses you have left over. And as a practical matter, the only countries in the world that run surpluses against China are the oil exporters. It's OPEC and Russia. Anything you have left over that you don't want to spend on Chinese goods that you're buying anyway in dollars already, by the way, we'll settle it for you in gold net in Shanghai, in Hong Kong, in London, in Dubai. And that's what is happening. Now, paradoxically, the faster they de-dollarize, the more upward pressure they're going to put on the dollar, which is a whole separate discussion, which means they will then have to accelerate their treasury FX reserve selling. So the issue is, yes, can they run the track of negative real rates? Absolutely. Do they need to? Yes, absolutely. The challenge is that they allowed the debt to get so high, to your initial point of, hey, debt doesn't matter because we're the West. Well, it does once it gets to certain levels. Once it goes over 100%, like, you're done. You don't get the option of positive real rates anymore. And if you can't do positive real rates, the higher that debt goes, the more negative they have to be, or else you're going to have this debt spiral. And of course, the problem is that the higher the negative real rate, right, the higher the inflation, the less incentive there is globally to hold this debt in the first place, because nobody wants to be the sucker at the card table losing 10 to 20% per year in real terms. It makes no sense. You're better off moving your supplies into gold, or reserves into gold, moving reserves into oil, into commodities, which also is what we're seeing happen.
Yeah, this is pretty fascinating. So I think, I mean, there's a lot that I want to comment on. So I'm just going to, when you discuss the World War II scenario, I think a main difference between now and then is that after World War II, savings rates were quite high. And so if you devalued people's debt, you know, bondholders got wrecked, but most bondholders also had a lot of savings. Now nobody has savings because everybody's been conditioned after 1971 that you don't hold anything in cash other than, you know, your monthly expenses. Cash is trash. Everybody knows this. This was not the case in the 40s and 50s. Cash was redeemable in gold. Not entirely redeemable, but there was, you know, you couldn't redeem it as an American, but foreign central banks could redeem it, and that gave it a sense of stability and the expectation that its value is going to appreciate over time. And now it's different. So the main, perhaps to go back to your point about why they started down that track of negative real rates and reversed, I think the answer is probably that this is a lot more difficult now than then. Then there was a world war, and people have had some savings. Now there's no world war, and, well, by the time we publish this, who knows? Luckily enough for now, at least we can get to say this. But that means that if they were to go with negative real rates, the effect is going to be a universal policy of, as Bitcoiners like to call it, have fun staying poor. The world is going to get wrecked. You're going to get negative real rates on your returns, and therefore it's going to be financially devastating for retirees and for savers across the world. So I get why this is politically unpopular, but I still think, perhaps, don't you think they could do this through not necessarily having real negative rates as measured by bond yields minus CPI, but through having real negative rates in terms of measured by bond rates minus actual inflation, which is obviously much higher than CPI always, because CPI is designed to understate inflation in real terms. And I discuss in detail in the Fiat Standard why I think that is the case. And I think I haven't seen compelling arguments against that. I think there are no compelling arguments for the fact that the CPI is an accurate measure of inflation. I think the entire idea of wrapping up CPI into one number is mathematically meaningless. And I think the way that it is measured, it doesn't take into account the fact that people substitute away from expensive goods into cheaper goods when the price of goods goes up. So that is going to necessarily understate inflation. So don't you see this being a way out, that yields will remain negative, will remain positive in real terms, and people will be happy about them, but they will go down in real terms without looking at the CPI? And that's how we achieve universal have fun staying poor. Everybody's happy because they're making their positive yields, but they, you know, they look at the CPI, they look at the yields, they think they're doing fine, and in reality, they're just getting impoverished. You don't see that as being a way out?
For domestic Westerners, I agree 100%. That'll be what policymakers will attempt, are attempting, have been attempting. The challenge is that there's more than one constituency with savings, right? So it is, you know, the domestic people, yes, you domestic Americans saying, "Hey, I'm making positive real returns," but you're really not. That's one thing. The other side are the global foreign creditors of the United States, who we will broadly divide into two camps. There are the foreign creditors of the United States who are oil importers. So China, India to a lesser extent, China, Japan, Europe, primarily the South Koreans. But it's really China, Japan, and Europe. Then we also have the oil exporting foreign creditors of the United States, which are, in short, OPEC and Russia. These groups of U.S. creditors have a lot of savings. Those they're called FX reserves. They're called treasuries. Ultimately, in those places, they can tell their people that they're getting a positive real return. But in the end, the importers need to have oil. They can't say you're earning a positive real rate, but if oil's going up, they have to sell treasuries to get dollars to buy oil. That doesn't matter what the CPI is. They are sellers of treasuries, and they will continue to be sellers of treasuries. The flip side, of course, is that if you are Russia, if you are OPEC, if you are Saudi, etc., you have oil, and oil prices are going up structurally because of peak cheap oil. The value of the oil that you control in the ground is rising against treasury bonds, because of the inflation in oil and because of the fact that the U.S. government cannot afford to pay a positive real rate relative to the average inflation of oil because of what's happening to the geology of oil, peak cheap oil. So if you're Russia, if you're Saudi, you're facing a choice where, okay, I sell my oil, I get my dollars, I buy treasury bonds, and then my treasury bonds fall by 3, 4, 5, 8, 10% per year on average against the value of my oil in the ground. And at some point, every oil field on the planet has peaked and rolled over. And once that happens, the day Russian oil rolls over, the day Saudi oil rolls over, Iraqi oil rolls over structurally, oil prices go up 50, 100 points in a very compressed period of point of time. And now, these U.S. foreign creditor oil exporting nations will be sitting on paper that they took in return for oil, and then they're going to need to go back out into foreign markets and buy back oil that they sold over the last 50, 60, 80 years, except that paper is going to buy them way less oil than it did when they sold the oil. And so these oil exporting creditors are starting to look at this dynamic and go, okay, I can see peak cheap oil is a reality. It is an undeniable reality. We're not running out of oil, but the biggest 90% of global production growth of oil in the world over the last 10 years has come from U.S. shale. And U.S. shale needs at least $60, at least, probably more now. And it needs to rise over time or else production doesn't grow. And if production doesn't grow, all that paper they're holding, that debt can't be made money good in nominal terms, because demand for energy from humans is infinite, and most of that energy is still oil, and it's going to still be oil for years and years and years to come. So you have two different sets of creditors, the oil importing U.S. creditors and the oil exporting U.S. creditors who cannot afford to get anything but a real rate on their treasuries. In other words, if you are China, Japan, or Europe, you can't afford to have oil go up more than your treasuries and continue to store your surpluses in treasuries. You're going to run out of treasuries. And when you do, you're going to have a currency crisis. You're going to hyperinflate like Iran did, like Argentina did, like Turkey did. That is completely politically unacceptable. And critically, while Europe and Japan are friends, China is an adversary. China has nukes and they will not stand for it. And that's why they're de-dollarizing their commodity imports. Similarly, Russia, OPEC. OPEC is located in a place in the world where if they run out of dollars because they sold their oil for treasuries that fell against oil over a long enough period of time and then their oil production drops, that isn't going to work out in a peaceful manner for the leaders involved in particular. And so it is simply not going to be allowed to happen. They simply will not store surpluses in Western paper that falls against oil over time. They're better off leaving the oil in the ground and waiting. Or failing that, since that is not a particularly good thing to do, and I think ultimately these oil nations are interested in playing their role in global stability, what they will do is stop growing holdings of treasuries and they will start growing holdings of gold reserves. They will start investing in refineries in China, like the Saudis have been doing, to the tune of multiple billions of dollars. You will start seeing the treasury get cut out entirely. So when you see China show up in Qatar, a U.S. ally, and say, we'll buy a 27-year supply of gas in the ground today, and then 3 months later show up and we will buy another 27-year supply of gas in the ground today. That is China storing wealth in commodities. They're taking the risk, the depreciation risk of treasuries out. That's de-dollarizing their commodity flows. It de-dollarizes things for the Qatar because they can show up in Hong Kong, in Shanghai, and swap yuan for Chinese goods or gold in yuan terms. And it throws it all back onto the lap of the Americans, who, yes, can absolutely financially repress with real rates to their own domestic audience, but they can't do it to foreigners, and they definitely can't do it to foreigners who have nuclear weapons like Russia, like China, and like others.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, I think that is, I'd say, I find that compelling to a degree, and I agree with the overall analysis, but I think I disagree with the underlying point of peak cheap oil from a geological perspective. So we've had a discussion here with Gail Pooley, an economist who's written a book called Superabundance, along with Marianne Tupi. And the two of them are influenced by the work of Julian Simon, who's a great economist. And I mentioned him in my principles in the Bitcoin Standard as well in Principles of Economics. It's a quite pivotal chapter in the book where I discuss his idea that the ultimate resource is human time, and that if you look at all the physical resources of Earth, they continuously just get more abundant. And the limit on how much we can make of all of these resources comes down to how much time we can dedicate to the production of these resources rather than any kind of geological limit. And so over time, you know, the famously Julian Simon in the 1970s, he made a bet with Paul Ehrlich, who was a doomsday economist, still is, you know, he's in his 80s or 90s at this point, and he's still going on about how the Earth is going to kill us all very soon, or we're going to kill Earth because we are, you know, all the endless litany of bad things that environmentalists want you to believe that you're doing. And in the 1970s, because there was inflation, this idea that we're running out of stuff was very common. And yet Julian Simon bet Ehrlich that we're not going to run out of things. And indeed, we didn't run out. And here we are 50 years later, we haven't run out of any of those things. And all of those things are a lot cheaper in real terms. Obviously, they're more expensive in dollar terms. So all oil in the 1970s went from $2 to $30. Today, it's $80 or $90 or something in that range, which is a lot lower in real terms than $30. If you measure it not according, well, it's lower if you measure it in CPI, I presume, but also it's significantly lower if you measure it in terms of human wages, which is what they do. So if you look at the average wage of an individual, the average productivity of an individual, and you measure how much oil you could have bought in 1980, and you compare it to how much oil you can buy today, you find that everything is getting a lot cheaper. In fact, they have something called the Simon Index. They made in honor of Julian Simon, every year they update it with the prices of things. And you see that in real terms, the price of oil has gone down something like 50% in the last 40 years. I could share the chart with you here. So the 50 basic commodities analysis that you do from 1980 to 2022, you see with crude oil, the price back then in nominal terms in 1980 was $36. Today it's $97 at that time. So the price has gone up 1,634%. But in terms of the time price, it's gone down 51.2%. So it's down 50%. So if you work 1 hour now, you can buy twice as much oil as you could buy 40 years ago. And I think this is a very real trend in that things just get cheaper because we always make more of those things and we always find ways of making them in a cheaper manner because technology keeps advancing. So shale oil is just one manifestation of the same process. And I think it misses the point if you just look at it as shale oil was what bailed us out and allowed us to make cheap oil over the last few years or over the last decade. I think you're missing the point. The larger point is that there are always things like shale oil being discovered and being implemented, allowing us to have a much cheaper cost of producing those things. Realistically, in terms of the quantity of oil reserves, I think people just have a very difficult time wrapping their head around just how much oil is out there. I mean, the crust of the earth is so jam-packed with oil. And I believe there's quite compelling evidence to suggest that oil is not a fossil, or at least not entirely fossil. It's a naturally occurring substance. And I'm hoping to organize a whole episode where we discuss this. It's just a natural mineral that occurs on earth. Because we see that oil and gas can occur in meteors that land on Earth. So difficult to convince me that there were dinosaurs that died on those meteors and then decomposed and became fossils. And that's where the gas comes from. And I see no reason why. I think the burden of proof is on the people who argue that these are dead dinosaurs rather than the people who just say, well, this thing is enormously plentiful on Earth, then why couldn't it just be like any other mineral on Earth, like iron, like copper, like any of these substances that are enormously abundant? In fact, it seems like it is more abundant and it seems like it does regenerate. But in any case, whether that is correct or not, and I'm sure a lot of people will disagree, what you cannot disagree with is the fact that it is enormously abundant. So oil is just constantly getting cheaper and cheaper.
Let me add something to that because I agree 100%. You know, again, it's peak cheap oil. It's not peak oils, right? So it's important, I think, to note the context for when oil was $2 in 1970 and it finished the 70s at 36 and whatever, 1979, 1980, you had an 18-fold increase in oil. That did something really important, which was it basically demonopolized OPEC. In 1970, at $2 oil, OPEC was providing an uncomfortably large percentage of the United States oil, in particular because U.S. oil peaked in 1970. U.S. oil production peaked in 1970 and never surpassed its prior peak until, I believe, 2010 or 11 or 12, right? So we went 45 years without the United States producing more oil than it did in 1970. Number two, what that did from going from $2 to $36. And I think this is the where Ehrlich did a poor job of framing his bet. And again, it ties to peak cheap oil, not peak oil. When oil went from $2 to $36, UK North Sea that had been uneconomic became economic. Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, which had been uneconomic at two, became economic at 36. The Gulf of Mexico deep water had been uneconomic, became economic. And all of a sudden, the fact that prices rose by 18-fold brought on more supply, which absolutely supports the peak cheap oil point. Here's the second derivative that I think that argument is not fully considering, which is in 1970, the United States had already, when oil was two and we took oil up 18x, the United States to increase oil supplies and to make Ehrlich wrong and Simon right, the United States had already taken debt to GDP from 110% in 1946. 24 years later, it was down to 25%. And so the United States had the option of letting oil rise 18x to drive the growth in these supplies. Now, I'm not saying oil is going to run out. I'm not saying that Ehrlich was right and Simon was wrong. I'm saying that it's a multi-tiered problem, which is at 120% of GDP with somewhere between 200 and 600 trillion in estimated notional interest rate derivatives that did not exist in 1970 when rates went from 2 to 15. If to grow the oil supplies we need to drive the economic growth is going to require a price response in oil that the bond market in real terms simply cannot take. Could oil go up 20x again? Yeah. If oil went up 20x again, would we see the rise in global oil production like we saw with UK North Sea, Cantarell and Deepwater Gulf of Mexico, Prudhoe Bay, Alaska? Yes, absolutely. Are these plentiful at the right price? Yes, absolutely. However, the problem is the global governments centered in the West cannot afford the interest rates that they would have to pay if oil goes up 20x. They couldn't afford to pay it if oil goes up 10x. They couldn't afford to pay it if oil goes up 2x. They can't afford it here. And that's the reverberation, right? And that sets aside, what does a 10x increase in oil prices do to $500 trillion in notional interest rate derivatives? Who owns that? What happens to the banks? What when one guy goes, notional becomes net when one counterparty goes broke? That's what we learned with Lehman, right? So now one guy goes bust. Those hundreds of trillions of notional derivatives are simply, they are all based on the debt portfolio, the derivatives, the banking system, Western sovereign debt, the structure of the global monetary system is all based on one bet, a readily growing supply of cheap and cheaper oil. That underpins all of it. And all I'm saying is if you want to grow oil supplies, you're going to need to grow price just like you did in the 1970s. But if you want to grow price like you did in the 1970s to drive the supply response, which is why Simon was right and Ehrlich was wrong, you got to get the debt to GDP down and you got to wipe out those derivatives. Otherwise, you're going to blow up the debt market because there's no sucker that will own $120 trillion in sovereign debt with oil rising 15x in 10 years. There just isn't one. Central banks have to buy it all.
So I want to get back to the peak shape oil thing, but why exactly won't, what is the exact causal mechanism that takes us from oil rising to people dumping their treasuries? Couldn't you make the opposite case, which is that all of this oil, if the price of oil goes up significantly, all of these oil exporters are going to have a lot of money on their hand, and a lot of that money is going to have to flow into the treasury market because that's still the most liquid, largest market, you know, $24 trillion or something like that. So what exactly, why exactly do you see oil price rising causing a decline in demand for sovereign debt?
Which OPEC nations are buying it? Russia's not. You think Russia's ever going to buy it again? Nope.
No, not Russia, but Gulf countries.
Gulf countries, I'm told, were quote unquote horrified by what the U.S. did with FX reserves. We've called MBS a thug, a murderer. He's all these words. You really think he's going to put all of his money into treasuries? And that's just the political side. The reality side is, I think when the Saudi finance minister, when the head of the IEA, when they come out, when the Saudi oil minister comes out and says the world needs $30 or $40 trillion in oil infrastructure investment over the next 5 to 7 years, or else the world is going to be short oil in 2027, 8 or 9. You can agree with him. You cannot agree with him. There are arguments to make either way, maybe whatever. That amount of tens of trillions of investment is inflationary. Only that does not say buy bonds, certainly not long-term bonds. That type of energy potential shortfalls does not say buy bonds. It says buy commodities, things that preserve value. And that type of shortfall, they're also, everyone in the world is aware, even though we don't like to talk about it in the West, everyone is aware that the emperor has no clothes in terms of where the Western fiscal position is. They know, everybody knows that we cannot sustain our debt position without the Fed printing the money. And you cannot store finite wealth or wealth whose value has to rise to grow production of it without it. And so I think that's really the key dynamic, which is this historically, there has been this yin and yang to the treasury market. Right. To your point, when oil prices went up, Japan, Europe, China, they sold treasuries to buy oil. The U.S. went into a recession. And so, yeah, we issued a few more treasuries, but we weren't running 8% deficits. We were running 2% deficits, maybe 4% at worst in the recession. And the OPEC nations were buying that with their surpluses. And Russia. Now, number one, they're not. Number two, they can't because they understand the peak cheap energy situation. Number three, they need to, you know, who's going to invest the 20, 30 trillion? Like, they can invest the 20, 30 trillion to make sure we have enough supplies, or they can buy treasuries, but they can't do both. They're going to do the first, not the latter. The political situation is a whole separate issue where we stole Russia's money. We defaulted on our Russian FX reserves, if you want to call it what it is. That was noticed throughout the Middle East, throughout the Gulf nations. And these oil importing creditors are seeing the same thing, which is push comes to shove. Set aside the politics. Set aside everything else. You're she. You're, you know, whatever. The German chancellor, I can't think of his name. Whoever. You're Macron. You have two choices. You can hold treasuries to help the Americans and let your people not have enough oil, or you can sell your treasuries and have your people have enough oil. Which do you do? There's not a choice. On the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, energy comes before the dollar. It comes before treasuries. It comes before everything else. Because otherwise, in the West, you'll be out of a job. In the East, in the Mideast, out of a job will be the happy outcome for you. And so that's why, again, there's a reflexivity to this dynamic that can't be looked at in concrete terms. Simon was right, Ehrlich was wrong. Well, yeah, because prices rose 20x in 10 years. Can prices rise 20x now without crashing the bond market? No. Without crashing 500 trillion or 200 trillion or whatever they are in notional interest rate derivatives? No. Can the treasury buying by the oil surplus nations happen when they need to invest 20 to 30 to 40 trillion in infrastructure to ensure supply shortfalls don't happen in 8 years? No, they can't. And it's this reflexive second and third derivative dynamics that I think are and remain and have been very underappreciated by observers.
Okay, a couple of nits to pick. First of all, if you look at the 1970s, I think it's people say the price of oil went up. I don't agree. I think if you look at the price of oil in terms of gold, as you can see in this chart, they didn't really go up. If you see here in the 1970s, you know, the price of oil charted against gold went up and down. It was highly volatile because everything was volatile when we went on the dollar standard. But here we are in 1980, it's around 10, 11. And in 1970, it was also around 10, 11. So there wasn't really a significant increase in the real price of oil. It was a big increase in the nominal price of oil. And of course, CPI understates real inflation. And there's an interesting, fun article in the 1970s about Arthur Burns and how he took out 70% of the things that are in the CPI and replaced them with cheap plastic crap that helps understate the CPI, the same tricks that they continue to play today. But realistically, there wasn't much of an increase in real prices of oil. And I think the other challenge to your idea here is, well, what happened after 1980? So even if I agree that the price of oil went up for 10 years from 1970 to 1980, well, after 1980, we had a 40-year bull market in bonds, a lifetime of bond appreciation. So what do you say to that? Does that change your mind?
No, that supports my view, right? So if we're in a peak cheap oil world, you can't. That chart tells you if oil is going to go up, you have to store surpluses in gold, not in treasuries, because gold will hold your value in dollar treasury terms and treasuries will not count. If you showed that same chart, I've published it for years for our clients, gold in oil terms was steady, volatile but steady, and has been for centuries, basically shortly after it was discovered in 1860. It's been remarkably steady. In contrast, if you look at how much oil a $1,000 face value treasury bond, right? Because the treasury bond can only face value $1,000. The only thing they can adjust is the interest rate. So in 1970, with oil at two, a treasury bought you 500 barrels of oil, right? $1,000 face value divided by two. Today, actually, not even today, 10 years later, that $1,000 face value treasury, you owned a 10-year treasury, it went from buying you 500 barrels of oil in 1970 to 25 barrels of oil in 1979, you're done. You can't afford oil anymore. So what do? You stop cutting oil because you don't have enough dollars. Guess what happens to your country? It collapses. Guess what happens to you? You probably get, best case, deposed. Worst case, a whole lot bloodier. That supports my entire point, which is peak cheap oil means to grow oil supplies like we did in the 70s, you need a price response. I'm not saying that price response won't happen and the supply response won't happen. What I'm saying is if for that to happen, you simply cannot store surpluses in Western sovereign debt because, again, the bond bull market was established by Volcker taking rates to 15%. Why did Volcker take rates to 15%? To stop the incipient hyperinflation that was happening in the United States. Critically, U.S. debt to GDP when Volcker started was 25%. He could not mathematically raise rates high enough to bankrupt the U.S. government. And when I say bankrupt the U.S. government, what I mean is he could not mathematically take rates high enough whereby the U.S. nominal interest expense would be above U.S. nominal tax receipts, leading to a classic emerging market where the central bank has to print the money to pay the interest on the debt, let alone defense, entitlements, national parks, healthcare, all the other stuff they buy. Now, we can't raise rates to 15. We can't raise them to 10. We probably can't raise them to 7 or 6. So that bond bull market was established by, A, the fact that bondholders got killed from 46 to 80. Because that's a part people will tend to leave out. There was a great chart in the Financial Times earlier this year. Bonds, on average, from 1901 to 1979, earned negative 1% average real rates. Yes, exactly. And then from 80 or 81 through 21, they had a positive real rate. And everybody thinks the last 40 years is normal. We're just going to go right back to that. Why were real rates so negative from 1901 to 1979? Well, simple. Governments borrowed a bunch of money to do dumb stuff and went off gold and then inflated it away. What have we just done? Governments have borrowed a bunch of money to do dumb stuff, fight financial, and then inflated it away. So again, the playbook of inflate the debt away is possible. But again, it helps if you start from a lower level or to just do it really fast, really big, get it over, basically write off the debt on a real basis, which is what we did. We wrote down the debt by 50 points of GDP in 5 years after World War II. And that was the U.S. Like, we wrote off debt holders. We wrote them off. We wrote that 50%, have a good day. That's what has to happen. And then that's fine. And that can be done. It's very easy mechanically. Fed comes out and says 10-year's not going over 2. We will buy every 10-year treasury you own. And then the mortgage market's going to put that to them. That they'll do that. And then the corporate market will put themselves to them. They'll buy all of that. The entire bond market will say cap it at 4, whatever. It's at 4 now, cap it at 4. Fed's balance sheet goes from $8 trillion today to, I don't know, 30, 32, 35 trillion. They own it all. Gold goes up a ton, recollateralizes central bank balance sheets. It recollateralizes sovereign balance sheets. And then the Fed normalizes after they, you know, the Fed's balance sheet goes up a ton. They own 8,000 tons of gold. They can buy it all. And then, you know, oh, by the way, oil's going to go up a ton. What's going to happen to the price response? It's going to go up a ton. The world is short $13 trillion. If the Fed's balance sheet goes to $32 trillion to buy back all of the debt and do yield curve control in the West, the value of the dollar is going to fall sharply. The world is short $13 trillion. If you're short $13 trillion and the value of the dollar falls sharply against commodities, all of a sudden, Saudi's going to be like, hey, we're ready to buy more treasuries again because our dollar debt's been wiped out. Our, you know, the European, everyone in the world that has this dollar debt, it will be wiped out on a real basis. It's the Great Reset. That's that playbook has to happen, but it is the reflexivity and playing around the edges and taking half measures won't work. You've got to do it. And this is ultimately where it'll go. It's just a path between here and there. And it's super bullish for stocks. Stocks will go to the friggin' moon. Like, you know, it's people say, you know, Argentinian stocks have gone up hugely in local terms.
Zimbabwe's stock market has been outperforming everybody.
Mm-hmm. In nominal terms, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, nominal, real, you know, what's the difference between friends? It's all the same.
That's what they try to tell you.
Exactly. Now, I think you make a pretty compelling case. I'll say a couple of more points that support your case. Is, as you said, obviously, the budgetary situation does not allow for 15% interest rates because it just leads to the debt spiral thing, which was not the case in 1980. They still had some savings in 1980, but we're in a brave new world of flying by the seat of our pants at this point.
And we're a lot less financialized, too. Think about that, right? So in 1980, the United States still manufactured stuff, and the United States' entitlements were still very cash flow positive. In other words, we had a lot more money coming in than we had going out to retirees. And now it's so financialized that it's like tax receipts back then did not fall as fast on every 100 basis points higher in rates. Now we're uber financialized, so we're very interest rate sensitive on the tax receipt side. So not only does interest rise nonlinearly, receipts fall nonlinearly. So your deficit blows out very nonlinearly, and we're negative cash flow on the entitlement picture, massively so. I mean, to the point that we're now, last year we spent almost 70% of tax receipts in health and human services and Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
Yeah, the demographics are just completely different from 1980. Yep. People are a lot older and people are working less. Yep. And I think another factor which makes a lot of our disagreement on oil moot is that the West is captured by an insane cult of people who think that staying warm in the winter is going to ruin the Earth's weather, and driving a car ruins the Earth's weather. And so the notion that European countries and the US and Australia could step up oil production if there is an increase in oil prices, I think, is a lot more difficult now. You know, look at Europe. They've had an energy crisis over the last 2 years. because of the war in Ukraine, and you don't see much effort to seriously invest in state-of-the-art oil, coal, and gas production, even though I believe the potential is there. I think the resources are there, and I think it's a lot of people in the geological fields and in the kind of engineering aspect of things, they look at outputs and they assume that that tells you what's going on in terms of reserves. And so in most people's mind, Qatar just happens to be sitting on an enormous amount of gas, whereas Germany's run out of gas. And I think that's not true. I think if Germany has invested over the last 40 years as much as Qatar has invested in gas exploration and in the development of infrastructure for finding gas, they'd be finding a lot more gas. It's not a lottery that you win. You know, you dig, you find, and they'd be able to find a lot more energy. The reason they're not finding it is not because geology has dealt them a bad hand. Europe industrialized on coal and oil, and they produced an enormous amount of it over the years. The reason they're not digging in is because they are captured by an insane cult that believes these things are bad for Mother Earth and that we need to go back to pre-industrial technology. We need to live on windmills. So I see that as being probably one of the most significant factors that you would need to add to the dollar debt crisis that you talk about, which is that you're going to be increasing the prices of everything drastically because people won't invest in the energy that is needed for modern infrastructure, for modern industry. And you're going to be making living expenses a lot more, living costs a lot higher. You're going to be creating more drag on governments because they're having to support an economy that runs on windmills, but with a population that expects to live by the living standards afforded by what their parents had in the 1980s and 90s, which was all based on wholesome hydrocarbons and powerful energy sources. So I think that's an enormous idea. And of course, you know, a lot of people dismiss this as, oh, well, we're doing the energy transition. We're just going to keep spending trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. And then eventually windmills will start working when the wind doesn't blow and solar panels will start working when the sun doesn't shine. And good luck. You know, maybe they will discover a way of making the sun shine 24 hours a day, but I don't think you should be counting on it in your scenarios.
No, that's exactly it. And this then reverberates back into the debt markets, which we're seeing in real time, right? We are seeing German manufacturing collapse faster than it did in the COVID crisis. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it's a collapse. French services ISM is falling as fast as it did in the 2012 euro crisis. And yet, unlike every other time in a developed country where you have these massively recessionary ISM readings, what are their sovereign bond markets doing? The yields are going up and up and up and up. Why? Because it's a debt crisis, because it reverberates back into the debt. And you say, I don't want gas. Okay, great. But that means you don't get to have the factories. If you don't have the factories go to China, the factories come to the US out of Germany, which is happening. And now you don't have the means to support your economy, to support your sovereign debt markets. And so the rates go up even more. And it touches up the, it is very misunderstood that energy, cheap, plentiful, growing supplies of fossil fuels underpin every other asset on the board, with the exception of physical gold held out of the banking system. And I would argue probably Bitcoin to a certain degree as well, with no counterparty risk. But even it has sort of the ongoing energy input that gold doesn't, but it's a technicality, in my opinion. That's this dynamic where, yeah, you're going to need severe pain to these domestic political constituencies in order to drive a change to the view that, okay, I would rather use gas, drill for gas, than be cold, than have my child be cold. I've got 43 solar panels on my roof. I've had them for 12 years. They're great. They reduce my electricity. With that said, I never disconnected my natural gas secondary. I also have geothermal. I've got wood burners here. I've got, you know, belt, suspenders, drawstring, and elastic approach in terms of my energy consumption. There is zero chance that even with a wood burner and with geothermal and with solar panels, I would ever consider disconnecting my natural gas. I would be a fool. I'd be a fool. And I think it's an important point of, it ties back to the Simon and Ehrlich point of, okay, you know, Simon was right, Ehrlich was wrong. Yes, because prices rose a lot and it drove an increased investment. Had people said, well, no, we're going to do this energy transition, that would have probably had a different outcome, number one. It would have definitely had a different outcome to the debt markets because it would have driven much higher rates of energy inflation. And people say, well, you know, the Stone Age didn't end for lack of stones. Correct. It ended because they came up with something better. We had the Bronze Age. Well, the Bronze Age didn't end for lack of bronze. Correct. Steel, coal, diesel, nuclear. Now, this is the first in light of that entire dynamic of global sovereign debt, deflationary tech pressuring that sovereign debt in terms of tax receipts, peak cheap oil. We have never in human history, as far as I am aware, tried to transition from an energy source that is higher energy return on invested energy to lower energy return on invested energy. And best case, that is extraordinarily inflationary and tells you, again, if I am a sovereign holder of debt as my wealth, I better get into gold. I better get into hard assets, ports, refineries, all this stuff that China, Russia, some of the others have been doing, investing in hard assets, not treasuries, which then reverberates. I don't think U.S. policymakers understand the second, third derivative of, hey, every time they say energy transition, there are people around the world going, sell treasuries moving into hard assets, sell treasuries moving into hard assets. This is inflationary. And just because they don't understand it yet, they being U.S. policymakers, doesn't mean this isn't understood in other parts of the world that are more pragmatic, less dogmatic about energy, energy return on invested energy, et cetera. So I think you're exactly right in terms of the implications that this all drives. And critically, you know, compounding interest doesn't sleep, right? It might take 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years for the populace of the West to wake up and go, oh, God, I don't like being cold in the winter. Let's vote for new leaders and change this. In the meantime, the U.S. debt's now compounding 5, German debt's compounding 3.5, so on and so forth. And it every single day, the interest bill goes up, even as the productive economy is shrunk by their energy decisions.
Yeah, I think that's pretty compelling. Now, what about your idea that the dollar is going to go up? Wouldn't this be bearish for the dollar? Wouldn't everybody, I mean, dumping treasuries, you would expect intuitively you would make that the price of the dollar, the real value of the dollar would go down.
So, and we started writing about this in 2014, actually, a report September 2014 highlighting that the dollar might be going up because we were seeing signs of global oil exporters de-dollarizing their commodity sales to China. The reason why, think about it this way, there's $13 trillion, give or take, of offshore dollar-denominated debt. There's $12 trillion in global FX reserves, call it 60% of that is in dollars, treasuries, by and large. If, you know, the oil market is a $2 trillion market, okay, so, sorry, $13 trillion debt, that $13 trillion debt has interest. The $13 trillion offshore dollar debt means there's a very large persistent bid for dollars to service that debt. So large bid, a lot of demand. Oil market historically only done in dollars. It's a, $2, $3 trillion annual market. As you start hiving off flows out of the oil and other commodities into, let's just say yuan for the sake of illustration, the flow, dollar flows created, you pulled oil out of the ground, you're creating dollars on some level, right? You pull the oil out, pricing it in dollars. Now, all of a sudden, you're creating slightly fewer dollars against a very large persistent bid for dollars. High demand, slightly lower supply, it's going to drive price up. Similarly, to the extent as China has no offshore yuan debt, no one wants to hold yuan, as everyone is loves all the dollar people like to say, thinking it's an insult, just an observation. There's no one wants to hold yuan debt. So there is no large installed bid for yuan. So as we hive off just a little bit of the oil market into yuan, we're creating yuan, we're creating offshore yuan that no one wants to hold in yuan debt. And even that's not entirely true, because by the way, the Chinese government bond market has vastly outperformed the treasury market since the yuan oil contract launched in 2018. But set that aside. No offshore yuan debt market to speak of. A little bit more of the oil market gets hived into yuan. Big increase in marginal yuan supplies offshore. against not much demand. What happens, yuan? A lot of supply, not a lot of demand, price falls. So paradoxically, the de-dollarization of global commodity markets is going to send the dollar up, which is going to drive more selling of treasuries because foreigners need to defend their currencies against the dollar rising, which will send rates up, which will send the dollar up. What is China doing to recycle the funds, the yuan? The yuan, they're going into Chinese goods and they're going into gold on a net basis. What's gold done in Chinese yuan? Up and up and up and up. What's it doing in basically every currency? Up and up and up and up. So that is a paradox. Now, will it eventually be bad for the dollar? Yes, really bad for the dollar. Eventually, you get to a situation. There's, you know, this machinery, this mechanism will recycle and recycle and recycle. And one of two things will happen. Either rates, treasury rates will hit a high enough level that the U.S. government can't afford it and the Fed steps in, caps rates. That part is bad for the dollar. Or the world, key players in the world like China, et cetera, run out of dollars to sell to defend their currencies, or currencies collapse like Southeast Asia in the late 90s. The dollar super spikes to the moon. And then everybody finishes dumping all their treasuries trying to defend. You basically have the dollar go to the moon and you have the global economy collapse. And then you have some sort of new system, or the Fed comes in and buys it all. Because the reality is receipts in the U.S. would be so deflationary. If that happened, you basically would be to that point where the U.S. government couldn't cover its interest expense out of tax receipts. And so they would either have to choose to default on treasuries, or they would have to print the difference, which is really bad for the dollar. So it's like super, super good, and then bad is de-dollarization. So when people say, oh, the dollar's going up, de-dollarization isn't happening, that's not right. But de-dollars, the first thing you'd see with de-dollarization of global commodity markets is you would see the price of the dollar rise against those other currencies. You would see the price of gold rise in those currencies. You would see the price of gold rise against oil, which since 2008, when Russia started buying oil, gold has gone from buying 8 barrels of oil to 20 plus barrels of oil. Price of gold in oil terms has risen almost 3-4x in the last 10, 15 years.
But I mean, that's probably if you just pick the peak of the 2007-2008 oil bubble, which coincided with the peak of the business cycle at that time. I think if you go back to 2006, 2005, 2004, it isn't that big of a difference. I don't have the numbers in front of me.
2006, you talk about $600 gold and $50, $60 oil. So you're, you know, 10 to 12 barrels up to 20, 24 barrels. So you're still, you know, you've still doubled your oil prices in, or doubled your gold prices in terms of oil in that time. So it's still trending in the same direction. Whereas from 86 to 2006, it was less, you know, a very pronounced trend down in terms of how much oil gold bought.
Yeah. But I mean, as they dump treasuries, that destroys their demand for dollars. Why do you need dollars anymore if you've dumped your treasuries?
Because you've borrowed $13 trillion in offshore euro dollar markets, and because still a lot of your commodity import bill is done in dollars, and human demand for energy is infinite. No, there's no country on earth that has seen its fossil fuel demand that isn't collapsing. Like that, it goes in one direction on a per capita basis.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. I mean, if your fossil fuel demand is declining, then you are in very, very deep trouble. You are deindustrializing. You're going to get significantly poorer, and the quality of life is going to be deteriorating very, very
rapidly.
Yes. Regardless of what all the statistics show you, GDP numbers and CPI numbers, all of that is nonsense. If you're not consuming hydrocarbons, then...
Well, that's a perfect thing, right? And I think this is something Russian policymakers understand that a lot of the U.S. ones don't, which is... if your hydrocarbon consumption is falling, paradoxically, you know, beyond a certain, if you're collapsing, if you're economically collapsing, your hydrocarbon consumption will fall and your GDP will go to the moon because you'll be hyperinflating and your GDP is counted in currency terms. When realistically, what really matters is your energy consumption. What is your energy consumption doing? That is what tells you what your economy is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when this stuff happens, your argument is that gold is likely to go up. Let me give you a bear scenario for gold, and perhaps also a bullish scenario for treasuries, which is that ultimately, underlying all of these trends, whatever happens, I think perhaps it's useful to think of demand for treasuries and demand for gold as being demand for cash balances. And you were saying that people are going to have to dump their treasuries because they're going to want to buy energy. And I think that's there's truth to that in some sense. You need to stay warm more than you need to get robbed by the treasuries. But I think there's a little bit of a lack of overlap between those two markets. In other words, your demand for treasuries is demand for cash. The treasuries are cash replacement. And your demand for energy is consumption demand. And so it's a little bit like saying your energy bill at home is going to compete with your checking account. In a sense, yes, if oil prices go up, if your gas prices go up, you're going to need to pay your bills. You're going to go broke. But if you're not broke, and in most of those countries, they don't really have a savings account. Pretty much all governments don't really have a savings account. They've got a checking account. So because nobody saves anymore, because it's pointless to hold significant amounts of cash. So they live hand to mouth. And so their demand for treasuries is a little bit like your checking account. It's just the money that you have until the end of the month that you pay for day-to-day expenses with, and you don't keep a lot of money there. So if you think of it this way, then the demand for treasuries is not very susceptible to competition from these other assets because, again, it's just your checking account. So next month you're going to get paid and you're going to pay all of your bills, but then you're going to keep all of your spending money in your checking account, and you're going to have to manage your expenses in a way where, you know, by the 25th of the month, you're going to need to have some dollars to eat in your checking account. So if you think of treasuries in that sense, because nobody holds long-term cash balances, people just hold day-to-day, hand-to-mouth cash balances, then thinking of the treasury market, even though it seems enormous in terms of its size, because it's $24 trillion, and indeed it is enormous, but maybe it's not enormous. Maybe it's not that enormous, or in other words, it's not that elastic. The demand for treasuries is not that elastic because at the end of the day, that's the only place where you can get in and out of large amounts of, in and out of large positions with relatively high liquidity. At least that's what the advertisement says, that we're a $24 trillion market. The Fed is buying, the Chinese are buying, the Saudis are buying. So if you're an institution, there aren't many assets with that kind of deep liquidity, wherein, say, you're the Saudi sovereign wealth fund and you decide you want to buy Neymar or Cristiano Ronaldo or something like that.
Mbappe.
There aren't many Mbappe. Yeah, there aren't that many markets where you can just dump $1 billion, and you can't just dump easily $1 billion of emerging market stocks or yuan or Chinese bonds or Indian bonds. Chinese bonds, you know, they don't even have open capital markets. So it won't be very easy for you to sign Mbappe, dump $1 billion, get the $1 billion in cash in your account by the next working day, and then send them to Mbappe's mom and agent, the same person. It's a little bit tricky. So if you need this kind of very large position, there still aren't that many alternatives to the treasury market. And gold is nowhere near being as similarly liquid because the gold market is controlled by the LBMA, the London Bullion Market Association. And there's just not that much depth and liquidity for large positions.
The physical market, the paper market is just about as, if not more, but just about as liquid as a treasury market, the paper market is. But the physical market, absolutely not.
But even the paper market, I mean, the physical and the paper market are a total of about $8 trillion, right?
Yeah, but the turnover is like 100 times that.
I see.
Yeah, which is the whole ruse on the paper market. Separate discussion, to your point.
Yes.
Physical market, absolutely. But the paper market, but your point's well taken, right? So, but I think you have to take a step back from a first principle standpoint and say, well, what else are they going to do with the money? And from a first principle standpoint, you have to look at terms of trade and say, what money? It's a checking account. But if oil's high enough, Americans are running bigger deficits. So we're selling more. Inflation's going up, so the Fed's selling more to try to fight inflation. If oil's going up, the highly financialized U.S. economy doesn't do well with oil, high oil prices. There's a number of different things showing that. You're going to be sort of deleveraging the financial. Banks own $4.1 trillion in treasuries and mortgage backs that they allegedly are holding to sell in case of a credit problem, which is starting commercial. So they're selling, all else equal, unless they're flipping it to the Fed or swapping it to the Fed with BTFP. But more importantly, from the foreign side, we can look and see oil prices are 90 bucks, 85 bucks. Saudi's running a deficit. Russia's running a deficit. Europe's running a deficit. China's barely running a surplus. So if all of those nations, Japan with oil at 90 bucks, has to sell. Maybe it's 95 bucks. They're short energy. They are in. So everywhere, you have to take a step back before you say, where else are they going to put the money? You have to take a step back on a first principles basis, look at the terms of trade and say, what money? Terms of trade, everybody's running a deficit. Where's the money going? Well, the Saudis are running a deficit in part because they're spending on their different domestic initiatives, right? They're building whatever the cube thing, and they're paying Mbappe, and they're buying golf, and but they're also looking ahead and saying $20-30 trillion of infrastructure. And we want to be a major player in LNG, not just oil. And all that shit takes, excuse my language, it takes infrastructure. It takes pipes. It takes steel. It takes commodities. It doesn't take treasuries. Who's got that stuff? We don't make that stuff anymore in America. And after last year, the Germans don't make it anymore either. And so who are they buying it from? Well, the Chinese. So then what are the Chinese doing with the money? Well, the Chinese are taking their surpluses to the extent they exist. And you can see this because, Brad Setzer looked at it the other day and said, their FX reserves are flat and dollar reserves are flat. They're down from 15, but they've been flat over the last 6 years. And dollar share of that is flat, so they're not de-dollarizing. Well, they've been running $200 to $600 billion current account surpluses every year since 15. 8 years, 7 years times, say, $300-400 billion on average. That's somewhere between 2.1 and 2.8, call it $3 trillion in current account surpluses that didn't go into FX reserves. Where'd they go? They went into Belt and Road. They went into infrastructure. They went into commodities. They went into joint ventures on refineries in Saudi, in China. And so you have to take a step back and say, where else are they going to put the money? What other financial market they're going to? There is no other financial market. You can put it in paper gold. It's liquid enough. They're not doing that. They're putting some in physical. It's not big enough yet. I think it eventually will be, but that's not here. They are putting the whole system is changing. Everybody's framework for this is the wrong framework from a first principles perspective. What else can they do but put the money in treasuries? Belt and Road, African investment, buying commodities in the ground, the Port of Piraeus in Greece, half of the infrastructure in Peru, which the FT was just writing about. The Chinese have bought so much of Peru's infrastructure, ports, and commodity base, the United States State Department is raising issues about it publicly in the FT. And so the answer is what else is liquid enough? The real world. The real world is liquid enough. What's the benefit? Gosh, like Josh Wolf testified to Congress 3 months ago, 2 months ago. He pointed out that the Chinese can now build and deliver a nuclear fission power plant, 1 gigawatt, 1 gigawatt for $2 billion. Now, if you're the Saudis, if you're fill in the blank African nation, would you rather own $2 billion of treasuries or would you rather own a Chinese built nuclear fission plant that can desalinate water for you and improve the lives of your people? It's a layup. It's not even a question. You build it with China. Well, how can the U.S. compete with that? Well, we build nuclear power plants. Okay, great. What does it cost? Well, to build the same 1 gigawatt in America costs $12 billion. The gigawatt's a gigawatt. Nobody gives a crap where the gigawatt comes from. They just want the clean water and they want the electricity and they want the increased living standard driven by that gigawatt. So who are they going to go with? It's not even a choice. They're going to go with the Chinese. And so what else can you do with the money? You build China, you buy Chinese power plants from the Chinese. You tie yourselves more to the Chinese politically. You buy the Chinese, take the money. There is this whole other developing world where basically the world is saying, you know what? From 1945 to 2008, the deal was we will reduce our living standards to buy treasuries and finance the Americans. And up until about 1990, that made a lot of sense because they needed protection from the USSR. Once the USSR collapsed, there was like, okay, well, now what? And we probably should have restructured the system then, but we didn't. Then after 01, there was sort of the global war on terror. Okay, we need protection from the Americans for that. And now it's kind of like, well, do we? And the choice is no longer treasuries or yuan or euro debt or yuan debt or rupee debt. No. It is treasuries or electricity with $2 billion per gigawatt Chinese power plants or Belt and Road or a train station or an airport or, you know, Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary of the United States, 6 months ago said what they get from China is an airport. What they get from the Americans is a lecture. People are sick of being lectured. We've been too hypocritical about virtually everything, geopolitics, the money, the currency system, all of it. And so they're saying, you know what? What's my alternative to treasuries? More electricity for my people, more fresh water for my people, a road for my people, a train station for my people. Oh, by the way, it gives me jobs. It develops my country. And we're watching it happen. And so the framework, the framework is the wrong framework on a first principles basis. It's not an issue of what are they going to own besides treasuries? Nothing. Nothing's going to replace the treasury. I mean, gold will on the margin, but they're taking money they would have lent to the Americans to bomb their own countries. And they're building themselves train stations and nuclear plants and roads and improving their standards of living. That's what's happening. And it's going to keep happening. And the flip side to that is, paradoxically, that's really good for the dollar. Because guess what happens? The American deficits are still going up and up and up. And if the Fed's not printing the money to buy them, they're going to crowd out global dollar markets, which is going to send the dollar up, and it's going to force foreigners to de-dollarize faster and sell more treasuries. So there's this, what else are they going to do? They're going to invest in themselves. They're going to stop financing their military encirclement by the United States. And we're literally watching it happen in real time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best counter argument to come up with that is that train stations and seaports and all of this infrastructure stuff is great, but it's no checking account. You can't liquidate 3% of a seaport in order to buy something if you need it. So you still need the checking account.
No, absolutely. And that's where, you know, that's where you see when you see the IMF accept Chinese yuan from Argentina, right? When Argentina says, uh-oh, we're running out of money because we spent all our dollars on seaports and the Chinese say, hey, no problem. Here's a yuan swap line. Take this. And then the Argentinians turn around to the IMF and go, hey, we can't pay in dollars, but here's yuan. And critically, the IMF, which in my opinion and a lot of other people's opinion is simply a policy tool of the United States, says, okay, we'll accept them. And they took them. So the need for liquidity is an absolute need. I agree 100%. But China's willing to accept that liquidity. And what am I going to do with the yuan? China's the factory of the world. You buy everything we buy.
They don't have open capital markets.
Not only on a limited basis. The Chinese yuan is convertible through gold and through oil, actually, as well. You can convert offshore yuan in gold in the Shanghai Gold International Exchange. You can do it in Hong Kong. You can do it to a lesser extent in London. Now, but it's not that big. Of course, it's not that big. But if gold was, if you added a zero to gold, yuan would be a lot more convertible. But that would have a reverberating effect in terms of the implications on the dollar. It's a very elegant way of managing your capital account. Basically, we will open our capital account. The Chinese aren't stupid. They know the second they open the capital account, it's going to get weaponized against them. So how do you open your capital account a little bit to give yourself some credibility while not allowing it open enough so that the Americans and the traditional people that have exposed open capital accounts to create emerging market debt crises and currency crises use gold? Listen, if the Americans want to bid up gold to create a capital flow out of China, they could do it. But that requires a much higher price of gold. And the Americans are allergic to a higher price of gold, not least of which is because a much higher price of gold will send inflation expectations up and it's going to blow up the U.S.'s debt markets. The Chinese understand the way this has been weaponized in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think here, this is where I go back to my tried and tested basics of monetary competition. and the problems of gold, I think, in today's world. I mean, you've read the Bitcoin Standard, so you know the first seven chapters are basically a glowing tribute to gold. But I think realistically in today's world, I think there are the two main problems with gold that prevent it from playing this role. Number one, building a physical settlement system that allows you to move gold around the world quickly and cheaply is just, it doesn't exist at this point, and it's going to be extremely expensive even if you build it really efficiently and you invest in it heavily. There's no way of verifying the authenticity of a giant, well, not giant, but you know, the standard gold bar, which is about 400 ounces, $700,000 worth of gold. This is the kind of standard unit of trading on the gold blockchain, if you want. If you're going to be trading, if you're going to be making gold into money, this is going to be the thing that's going to be getting shipped from China or from the rest of the world to China, most likely, to settle the trade for the goods and services. And the only way that the Chinese are going to be able to verify that this is an actual gold bar, they're going to have to melt it down and cast it back up again into a gold bar. And that's going to make it very difficult and very expensive to do. And the second thing, I think, which is a related point, is just the enormous amount of tungsten that's out there in the gold market. So you can go on Alibaba.com. You can buy gold coins, 1 ounce gold coins that are full of tungsten. So these should be worth about $1,800, $1,900, but you can buy them on Alibaba, have them shipped to you in the US for about $400 or $500, because on the inside it's full of tungsten. And that's, yeah, I mean, if you can get it on Alibaba, that means it's probably quite common. And I think beyond just the risk of you buying a gold bar or a gold coin that ends up getting that ends up being fake, I think the structural risk that this poses for the gold market is that you're constantly getting a high increase in the supply of gold every year and a churn of that supply. So every year there's as I discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, what made gold money is that the stock-to-flow ratio of gold is high, or the supply growth rate is very low. So every year you only grow the supply at around 1.5%. And what makes that the case for gold is that there's no way of consuming gold. There's no way of getting it out of circulation. So every year, no matter how much more you produce, you're just adding to the stockpiles. So next year you produce more, the stockpile's gotten bigger, the growth rate remains roughly constant, around 1.5 to 2%. But that goes out of the window when two things happen. Number one, when you have all of these fake gold bars and coins coming onto the market, well, then the growth rate might be closer to 5 or 10% per year, because you're getting in a large amount of gold coming in. And every year, people are discovering that some of the gold that they got last year and the year before and the year before and before is actually tungsten. And so that gets scrapped out of the market. So we're back to gold being, well, not back, but we're witnessing gold being transformed into more and more of a consumption good, because it kind of gets consumed because a lot of it is tungsten. So the tungsten gets thrown out. And now you don't have a 1.5-2% supply growth rate. You maybe have a 5 or 10% supply growth rate. And I think the other thing is the growing industrial use of gold. So a lot of the gold bugs will tell you, gold's bullish case is you use it for electronics, you use it for teeth, you use it for all kinds of other things. Well, maybe teeth is a bad one. Teeth is, but in all of these cases, because people die and then you can take their teeth. But in industrial use, when you take gold out of circulation, when you take it out of a monetary role, when you take it out of the form of a gold coin or a gold bar, and you turn it into an industrial appliance, you put it into microchips, you put it into computers, you put it into large machines or whatever, then that's effectively taken out of the monetary supply. So that brings the stockpile down, and that helps us get back to a lower stock-to-flow ratio or a higher annual supply growth ratio, which is what has basically, in my opinion, demonetized silver. You know, why silver today is predominantly an industrial metal. And so therefore, it's no longer a market where the impact of miners is insignificant. And that's what makes money for me. So I think if you don't solve those two things, and I don't see how they can be trivially solved, I don't see it working out for gold. And I think this might help explain why gold's basically been stuck around the same level for 12 years now, 13 years now.
I think it has. I think it has less to do with tungsten. I mean, I think on the margin that's the case. Coins are really hard to make. Certainly, the sovereign coins are very hard to make well and profitably with tungsten. I mean, bars. I'm sure it is a problem around the margin. I think the more likely explanation has been the expansion of unallocated paper gold derivatives, and you can see exactly how big a deal they are by watching what happened to the gold market centered in London in 2012 and 13, which was somebody showed up in London. You can see it. They took so much physical gold out of London. I want to say it was 2,000 or 2,500 tons of gold out of London in 18 months. Now, somebody demanded gold. Now, physical gold is the collateral underpinning the unallocated, the highly levered under unallocated gold market. What happened to the price of gold when somebody showed up and said, give me gold now? Price of gold didn't go up, it crashed. And the gold forward markets inverted, indicating a shortage of gold. Why did this happen? Because when you start pulling the collateral of the gold market out from under a highly levered system, the price of gold on our screens is not the price of gold. That is the paper, that's the price of gold. That is the price of gold credit. That's the price of unallocated gold. And when you start pulling physical out from underneath it, you drive some you invert the futures with the gold lending curve, forces selling. It's a derivative market. And so I think the main reason why gold has gone nowhere is because there has been allowed to be a massive expansion of unallocated paper gold from a number of different ways. It can be matched, right? It's like if someone shows up and demands a lot of physical gold, or demands a lot of coal, I should say, there's two ways to handle it. In an unlevered market, demand up, supply relatively flat, price goes up. In the gold market as it's structured, there's two ways. You can let price of gold go up, or you can increase the supply of unallocated gold promises by as much or more, and gold stays flat or goes down. And so I think that's what's happening. I mean, and in terms of the I agree 100% on the supply 1%. I agree 100%. The supply growth is not as hard. The stock to flow is not as hard as Bitcoin. It's harder than everything else, right? The stock to flow ratio is higher than everything else. That then, there's two things. Number one, the industrial side depends. Again, if they maintain the price, which they will need the unallocated derivative markets, which to maintain, that's going to have some supply issues. Otherwise, if price rises, it's not going to be as able to be used as industrial. But bigger picture, I don't think the average person would be using gold in this manner. I think it'll be a sovereign. And, you know, we saw this after World War II. The Saudis demanded gold from the Americans for their oil. And so every month, a plane got loaded up with bullion and flown to Riyadh. And we delivered the gold to them. And it's basically old school proof of work. Is it expensive? Yes. Is it a pain in the ass? Yes. Is drilling for oil and refining it and moving it and shipping it around the world difficult? Yes. And so it is. Is it the final solution? I don't know. But I think the solution is not as difficult. I mean, you can move. You can move a lot of gold physically out of Switzerland, around the world, in secure ways, on planes. I mean, look, you know, we all drink bottled water. Like, you know, we literally spend diesel fuel moving bottles of water around this country, rather than when we have pipes in the walls. So that's proof in and of itself that just because something's difficult and energy efficient doesn't necessarily mean it won't happen. And it's a proof of work. So the way you could work is you run a deficit in oil, you settle that in the next quarter in gold, put it on a plane, ship it. If you don't, the oil shipments stop. Simple. No energy, you know, no gold, no energy. The gold will move. I assure you the gold will move if that's the way you do it. Quarterly net settlement of energy in gold, it'll work. It's a much less smooth, more rudimentary, less efficient, 100% admit on all counts, proof of work mechanism than Bitcoin. But it's just a proof of work mechanism.
Yeah, it's just with all of these examples that you mentioned, I mean, obviously it costs a lot of infrastructure to get oil, but it is the cheapest way of getting cars to move around. And that's why it continues to be highly utilized worldwide. I think the key bearish case for gold is that it's no longer the cheapest way of doing this. Once people get, I think this is really perhaps the problem here, that once people get, all right, the answer is gold, then it's going to be very easy for them to get why the answer is actually Bitcoin.
I agree. I agree. And you know, somewhere between here and there, there's, you know, considerations among central banks. You know, do central banks get completely disintermediated if it happens fast, if it happens at a technology pace? You could see that happen, right? If there's a sort of an organic adoption globally of Bitcoin, yeah. If it doesn't, you know, central banks hold all this gold on their balance sheets for a reason. And it's sort of like gold is useless for 99% of the time of the long cycle. I didn't start liking gold till 08. You know, I bought, you know, most of my gold at 700, 800 bucks. It's not like I've been like a gold bug my whole life. I've simply like, okay, 99% of the long economic cycle, you don't need gold. 1% of the economic cycle, the only thing you need is to get rid of counterparty risk and counterparty risk in sovereign debt. And for the first time in any of our careers, Western sovereign debt has either inflation risk or counterparty risk. It's one or the other. If they have positive real rates, the debt to GDP this high, deficits to GDP this high, they will mathematically default on Western sovereign debt. It is a sixth grade math problem. If they don't do that, then they have to keep real rates negative and they have inflation risk. And it really comes down to that. I mean, 120 years, Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff did this time it's different, right? 500 years of debt crisis. Last 120 years, every country that hit 130% debt to GDP, 98% of them have defaulted on their debt, most often via sustained high inflation. The only one that hadn't, as of 3 years ago, when Hirschman Capital laid this out using their data, was Japan. In the ensuing 3 years, how's Japan doing? Not so hot. So you basically have a 98 to 100% shot in the investments business, where a 52 to 55% batting average is Hall of Fame. So you don't get 98 to 100% shots in this business very often. What's that shot? That shot is you have to own assets, uncorrelated assets. You have to be overweight assets that are uncorrelated and that will do well as central banks try to manage and avoid Western sovereign debt having either default risk or inflation risk. And that's, in my opinion, those two assets are gold and Bitcoin are the two right at the top. I would probably put oil up there as well. And to your point, like, could we skip gold and go right to Bitcoin? Yeah, we could. I don't see the path there yet. But look, if Saudi came out or if Russia came out and said, you know what, we're only taking Bitcoin for our oil. Holy cow. Like, all right. What, or if the U.S. did it, hey, we're in trouble. The debt markets, all American deficits will be settled in Bitcoin going forward. Boom. Like, those are the types of things that could completely bypass the central bank regime. I'm not betting on it, those things happening, but I'm overweight gold and Bitcoin for a simple reason. You don't get 98% shots in this business. Everyone wants to say, oh, it's not different this time, Luke. You're right. It isn't different this time. 120 years, 98% of 53 countries had defaulted on their debt, usually via high inflation. It's 100% not different this time. It's just that most people think it's not different this time means something different than what it does, which is Western sovereign debt, including the risk-free asset U.S. Treasury bond, either has default risk or credit risk for the first time in anybody's career.
Yep. Yeah, this is the thing that most people aren't prepared for. But I think, you know, we generally have a theme here where with every episode, we end up on why Bitcoin fixes this. And I think all of these discussions are interesting to me in a kind of intellectual way as somebody who studied economics is curious about that stuff. But dear listener, I'm sorry for scamming you into listening to all of this stuff, because if you figured out Bitcoin... you don't need to know any of that stuff. You're still going to outperform anybody who's going to, in the long run, I think. This is the tricky part. I mean, a lot of people put out all of these macro theses, and they could be right, they could be wrong. But on a 5 year to 10 year to 20 year time horizon, it's going to be very difficult for anybody to outperform Bitcoin at the end of the day. Like, it is going to ultimately, whether the Saudis or the Chinese or the Americans end up using it or not, whether we skip gold and go straight to Bitcoin is kind of immaterial, because you can just skip gold and go to Bitcoin. You can skip sovereign debt and go to Bitcoin. And as Greg Foss says it, it's a credit default swap on, or it's an insurance on sovereign debt. And so if you've figured out Bitcoin, you've figured out the winning move from all of this discussion. You don't need to bother yourself too much with the interesting questions of, is oil going to go up or is oil going to go down? Is it peak oil or peak cheap oil? Or are we just going to get a lot of cheap oil? It's very interesting, but whatever happens, Bitcoin is the winning move. And that's the ease of life that that gives you, and the mental clarity that it allows you to just not have to worry about where am I going to move all of my life savings every day, and just go out there and live your life and figure out something to do to the world that's productive so that you can earn more money and save it in Bitcoin and have pretty high degree of confidence that you're going to pretty much outperform anybody else who's stock picking or trying any of those macro theses, I think is quite, it's a very underrated feature of Bitcoin. This is something that I keep harping on about, and I don't think enough Bitcoiners harp on about it. Just, and I always tell people, you know, if you're out there trading on the fiat markets, make sure you calculate your time and the cost of your time, and consider what would happen if you went and actually did your job or found another job, you know, went out and drove an Uber or whatever, and then spent all of that time just stacking Bitcoin, and then see if you're allowed to perform. Because the problem with trying to outperform Bitcoin with all of these theories and theses is not just that you need to outperform Bitcoin in terms of Bitcoin's performance. You need to also outperform Bitcoin, considering all the time that you're going to be spending having to study all of those things, having to look at all of the central bank policies, wake up every morning and find out which side of the bed Jay Powell woke up on and how he's going to be talking and what the Japanese central bank is doing, what the Swiss central bank is doing, and geopolitics and war and all of these things. So that's a lot of time, and trying to figure all of this stuff out. And it's time is money. You could be earning with that stuff. You could be working as a waiter and earning money. So make sure you include that in your calculations of outperforming Bitcoin when you do.
I think it's important too, in that, to always consider the real life experience of what happened here in the United States from 1933 to 1974, which was gold did great, preserved value. It was the gold of the time. But they also made it illegal to own for 40 years. And it's not my base case. It's not a negative case for Bitcoin. It's simply the practical reality that I think the last 10 years, and certainly the last 3 to 4 years, I think should force a reappraisal in everyone's mind what democratic Western policymakers might consider in terms of trying to shut down on and off ramps. And I understand that that doesn't necessarily, it doesn't change anything in the long run with Lightning Network and a lot of this other stuff that you have the ability to get around that. However, I think it's an important thing to just be aware of from an allocation standpoint of, you know, hey, if you want to go all in, are you prepared for your government to make you a criminal and freeze you? And if you are, great. They might do that for a bit. It might be 40 years. It's not my base case. But after the last 4 years, my own personal Bitcoin holdings, it has factored in of like, okay, what is the right level for me that I own that I can freeze for 40 years, or that I am, you know, willing to just lie very still and outweight them? And quite frankly, it's quite probably part of the strategy, right? Is they that's exactly what they want, are people like me saying, oh, what's the most amount I can freeze for 40 years while I'm a criminal? Which is, I think, without getting political, I think it's a suboptimal approach, but it is what it is, right? We have to look at the world as it is and our leaders as they are, not for what we think they are or what we think they'll do.
Even the most bullish Bitcoiner, we'll have to admit, 2020 will have seriously given you a lot of food for thought on that question. There was no way that in January 2020, if you told me how you're going to live through what's going to happen in the rest of 2020 and 2021 in terms of the lockdowns, in terms of the mandates, the money printing, the inflation, the travel bans and the work mandates, you can't work unless you get Pfizer products. All of that stuff was completely unimaginable before March 2020. And yet they pulled it off and the majority of people went along. And I always tell people, you can make your scenarios about what's going to happen based on how you think the world is right now. But once the hysteria has been activated, once the NPCs have had the new chips installed and the chip is just get angry. You remember March 2020, I was one of the very few people who was not on board with the hysteria. And I, you know, from day one, I said, just get sunshine and eat steak and live your life and stop hyperventilating. And in retrospect, that turned out to really be the best strategy because it turned out the virus, as with all diseases, is pretty much more dangerous for people who are in very bad metabolic health. So if you take care of your health, if you move, if you eat well, if you don't eat garbage and you get a lot of beef and you get a lot of sunshine, you were going to be okay and you didn't need to go through all the insanity that people went through. But of course, I got an enormous amount of abuse for that in 2020. And once that same level of hysteria is activated for something else, and you could say there was by the end of 2021, a lot of people had woken up, a lot of people had stopped being hysterical about COVID, and a lot of the people who were hysterical had switched teams and became hysterical the other way around and started going all mad about they're going to lock us up forever and they're going to make us take shots forever. And that turned out to also be a little bit exaggerated. And then there was a sense of, well, they did it with COVID and everybody realized that it was a bunch of bullshit and now nobody's going to fall for it again. But then the next current thing comes along. And again, you know, Charlie Brown and the football. And just... well, I'm not going to fall for it again because I already know it. So now I'm just going to go ahead and kick the football. And then the next current thing comes along and everybody's goes mad. And you saw it with Ukraine. You're seeing it now. And I think we're due for one on climate change. At some point, there's going to be a massive weather event, some hurricane or some tornado in some major city. And that's going to be viewed as evidence for how we're ruining the weather. And that's going to be used for a lot of... financial repression, probably, and just covering up a lot of inflation by telling you need to be poor because it helps fix the weather. And then perhaps one day when it comes to people's retirement accounts, things get really drastic. People realize what's actually happening with their bonds. Then that hysteria will be turned onto the Bitcoiners. So be careful out there.
Yeah. In short, absolutely. Yeah. It's just one of those things you have to be mentally flexible in terms of seeing possibilities and trying to see around corners.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's obviously Bitcoin's great, but perhaps other assets that are harder to confiscate. Well, not necessarily harder to confiscate because Bitcoin's pretty difficult to call. Well, it depends on what scenarios you are, but other assets that you could use like real estate and things like that might come in handy in this kind of scenario. So
yeah, some sort of balanced approach or some balance at least. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Luke, thank you so much for your time. And this has been absolutely wonderful, really informative. I thank you so much for putting up with all my questions and handling them like a pro.
I'm very flattered to be on and really enjoyed our conversation. So learned a lot. Appreciate you having me on.
Awesome. Do you want to tell us more about where people can find you and what things you do online?
Absolutely. For more information about our different mass market and institutional products, they can go to fftt-llc.com. And also have a pretty active Twitter feed at Luke Groman, LukeGroMen.
Excellent. All right. Thank you so much, sir. Have a good day.
Absolutely. Thank you, too.
Cheers.